Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're really blessed to have David Seeloff with us. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. He does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin, and you can visit their website. It is askelm.com. That's askelm.com. And you can email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And we are continuing our series, The People That History Forgot. And right now, we are in Chapter 9. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. Chapter 9 is titled The Neighboring Nations of the Jews in Palestine. And, of course, these are Dr. Ernest L. Martin's words. And let's get into Chapter 9.
Okay.
Before understanding the full story of what happened to the Samaritans who went to Europe and became Christians, and to know what happened to some other peoples who were similar to them, we must look at the development of what is called Rabbinic Judaism after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And this is a fascinating story. The records show that Judaism, that is, mainline Judaism, became very isolated from other peoples who were once their neighbors in the Middle East, in North Africa and Europe, from 70 AD onward. This isolation is what caused Rabbinic Judaism to develop into what was practically a unified belief system during the crucial period of the 2nd, 3rd, and up to the 6th century AD. And from the destruction of Jerusalem onward in 70 AD, and especially after the War of Bar Kokhba in 135 AD, Judaism, for all practical purposes, was an island to itself among the nations and religions of the world. But this was not the case in the period before 70 AD. In the 200 years before the destruction of the Temple and Jerusalem, Judaism steadily became a very popular religious belief among many of the Gentile peoples who lived near the Jews in Palestine. Quite a number of people from the surrounding nations were prone to accept Judaism and the Jews in a very favorable way. In fact, two of those nearby peoples had been forcibly converted to Judaism, with their men having to be circumcised. One of these was the remnants of the Edomites, which in those days were called the Idumeans. And they were subdued by the Jewish king John Hyrcanus in about 125 BC and forced into circumcision and the Jewish rites. This is according to Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 15, Section 7. The other was an Arabian tribe called the Etrurians, who lived between the Sea of Galilee and the city of Damascus in Syria. They were forced by the Jewish king Aristobulus, about 100 BC, to submit to circumcision and to become Jews, or face expulsion from their lands. And this is also in Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, Book 13, Section 11. Now, many of them actually submitted and were reckoned to be among the Jews. So it could rightly be said that of both the Idumeans and the Etrurians, that many accepted their Judaism in a religious sense, often in a half-hearted way. And Josephus called them half-Jews. Although, obviously, there were some Idumeans who took their conversions very seriously. There were hundreds of thousands of people who made up these two groups. And the Romans normally came to consider them to be a part of the Jewish nation. However, both the Idumeans and the Etrurians disappear from the historical records as national peoples with the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So we need to ask what happened to those people who might have been seen by the Apostle John as among those who say they are Jews and are not. And John says this in Revelation 2 and verse 9 and in Revelation 3 and verse 9. We must also be aware of another major group of people who joined the Jews, often en masse, in the 100 years or so before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And these were known by the Jews as proselytes and God-fearers. The former would apply to Gentile men who became circumcised and took on the full role of being a new Jew, while the latter would often not submit to circumcision, but were those who practiced most of the other rites of Judaism. Of course, women were not subjected to circumcision, and many Gentile women in the surrounding area of Jerusalem, surrounding areas of Judea, adopted Judaism and reared their children within the Jewish religious society. Josephus mentions as an interesting example that almost all the women of the city of Damascus were practicing the Jewish religion. And this is in Josephus, Wars of the Jews, Book 2, Section 20, Chapter 20. And a great many Gentiles in Antioch, the capital city of Syria at that time, were Jewish proselytes. This is in Josephus, Wars of the Jews, Book 7, Chapter 4. In fact, Jews won over to their religious beliefs proselytes from all areas to which they migrated in the period before 70 AD, and there were also many Gentiles who became God-fearers and gave heed to Jewish ways. The essential reason why great numbers of Gentile peoples living among the Jews, especially in Palestine and Syria and Asia Minor, flocked to practicing Jewish ways, is because of the well-known expectation of the Jewish people that sometime in what we call the first century, a messianic figure would arrive who would bring in a worldwide kingdom in which the people of Israel and those connected with them would lead and control. In simple terms, people wanted to share in that prophesied kingdom that many people were beginning to expect. Both the Roman historian Tacitus in the Roman History, Book 5 and Section 13, and the Roman historian Suetonius in his Book of Vespasian, Chapter 4, mentioned the general belief of people throughout the Roman Empire in the first century A.D. that a world empire would emerge out of the East, notably in Judea. Indeed, Nero was even advised by his astrologers to move his capital to Jerusalem because they told the emperor that the sovereignty of the world was destined soon to begin to develop there. And this is in Suetonius in his book Nero, chapter 40. And because of these popular beliefs that the Jews were about to be exalted to world rulership, many Gentile peoples wanted to identify themselves with the Jews in order to share in that government, and many thousands of them did. Besides this prophetic expectation that caused Gentiles to gravitate to Judaism, it was then profitable in a monetary sense to to do so. Jerusalem and the area of Judea in the century before their destruction were highly prosperous regions, and whoever were friends and clients of the Jews had many financial gains that others did not have. The Jewish people in Judea were relatively wealthy during this time, and this especially applied to Jerusalem, where the temple was situated. The temple was responsible for bringing into Jerusalem huge quantities of monies and other contributions from Jews and even Gentiles from around the Roman and Parthian worlds. Note the words of Titus, the Roman general and later emperor, in a speech to the Jews just before the fall of Jerusalem. And this is from Josephus, Wars of the Jews, Book 6, Chapter 6. "We," meaning the Romans, "we have given you leave to gather up that tribute which is paid to God." In other words, he's talking about the temple tax. "With such other gifts that are dedicated to him. Nor have we called those that carried these donations to account." In other words, they didn't have to pay normal tolls. "Nor prohibited them, till at length you became richer than we ourselves, even when you were our enemies." So this tribute was the annual half shekel payment for the upkeep of the temple, which each Jewish male from 20 years of age upward had to pay each year. This money was collected from various sites all over the Roman Empire and conveyed in many instances under guard of the Romans themselves to the temple treasury in Jerusalem. This tribute alone, besides all the other offerings of money and animals, etc., that was sent to the temple, amounted to a prodigious quantity of revenue each year. Let's try to understand how much in 1993 U.S. dollars this might have been. Of course, 1993 was when Dr. Martin put this book together. The coin in the fish that Peter caught had the value of one shekel, called a stater in Greek. This would precisely pay the annual tribute for Jesus and Peter, according to Matthew 17, verse 27, for both of them, a half shekel apiece. A stater was equal to 4 drachma, and each drachma being a little more in value to a Roman denarius. A denarius, according to Jesus, was what a common laborer would receive in one day, as it says in Matthew 20, verse 2. Thus, a half shekel would equal about 2 days' work, since our minimum wage in 1993 is just under $5 an hour. A 12-hour day would gain a person about $60 at the present rate of in 1993. Thus, 2 such days would be $120. Based on our work per pay today, about $120 is what each Jewish male over 20 years of age would have to pay each year to the treasury of the temple. Since it is reasonably estimated that there would have been between 3 to 4 million Jewish males who would pay that tribute each year, this would amount to between 360 to 500 million U.S. dollars in 1993 just for the half shekel tribute alone. And that's a lot of money going to one place. The Sanhedrin at the temple in Jerusalem set that value of the half shekel each year. And the value was determined by the value of the animal sin offerings each year, according to the Talmud Shelekim Book 2, Section 4. If the value of sin offering animals went up, rose because of a scarcity, then the Sanhedrin would require more of the common currency to equal the amount of the shekel at the temple. The standard of value was set by the temple authorities so that God would have the same amount being given to the treasury each year, no matter what the value of coinage, whether it was inflated or deflated. Whatever the case, there were great quantities of money coming into Jerusalem each year, and this helped the economy of Judea and Jerusalem to be a very prosperous one. And also it assisted the surrounding countries of the Gentiles, who supplied materials to the Jews in Judea. They were equally thriving. And remember, because the Jews flowed to Judea for the feasts during three times of the year, Jerusalem was a convention town that expanded greatly during those periods of festival. So this wealth of the Jewish people made many Gentiles at the time want to share in this good fortune among the Jews. That wealth, however, came to an end with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. With all the metropolitan region of Jerusalem and the temple destroyed, and much of Judea devastated by the Romans, and with Jews beginning to be held in disdain and distrust by many Gentile peoples, there was very little reason for Gentile peoples to continue to want to be connected with the Jews after 70 AD. After that date, only practicing Jews called themselves Jews. So there was a further reason for not wanting a connection with Jews. To pay for the war of 66 to 70 AD and the actual remnants of hostility continued until 73 AD when Masada was taken, the fortress by the Dead Sea, and to cause a humiliation upon all Jews in the Roman Empire, Vespasian, the Roman emperor, decreed that the half shekel payment due annually to the temple, which was now destroyed, must go to the Roman treasury. This was a special poll tax that was deliberately intended to irritate and to humiliate the Jews. Besides that, the Jews were also forbidden to own lands in Judea. And with Domitian, the brother of Titus and the son, the second son of Vespasian. Domitian, the emperor, he made the tribute even more steadfast and added extra taxes besides to anyone who claimed to be a Jew. So let's read Suetonius, the Roman historian, a section from his Domitian about Emperor Domitian, Book 13. Quote, "The poll tax on the Jews was levied with extreme rigor, both on those who lived after the manner of the Jews in the city, without publicly professing themselves to be such, and on those who, by concealing their origin, avoided paying the tribute imposed upon that people." End quote. So these strictures placed on the Jews by the Roman emperors was a blessing in disguise, although that blessing was obtained through great suffering, because it actually helped develop what is now called Rabbinic Judaism. It not only solidified the Jewish people into a single society, but it jettisoned and eliminated from the group half-hearted or nominal Jews who left being Jewish behind because of the imposed hardships. It was easy, if the nominal Jews could show the Romans that they were not actually Jews, and this could be done, among other things, by sacrificing to the Roman gods. So, after the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, and with odium now being shown to the Jews, this helped to eliminate from Judaism all those who were not serious about keeping their Jewish identification. Indeed, there were two other historical events that happened in the period of 65 years that followed the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple that embellished and further created the desire of Gentiles not to be Jewish. In the time of the Emperor Trajan, about 117 AD, another war broke out between the Jews and the Romans. The conflicts were chiefly conducted in the island of Cyprus and in the land of Egypt and Cyrenaica in North Africa. In the island of Cyprus alone, the Jews, during this conflict, killed about 240,000 people and destroyed the city of Salamis. But they did not even win that war after their first victories. No figure is given on the number of Jewish people killed in Cyprus, but the losses must have been substantial. So severe was the reprimand of the Romans against the Jews that all remaining Jews were expelled from Cyprus and forbidden to return. And though some Jewish scholars feel that Jews did return shortly to the island because archaeology has shown Jewish symbols on certain artifacts found in ruins which date after 117 AD, our research in this book shows that such Jewish symbols are no guarantee that the later people were in fact Jewish. As for Jewish losses in Egypt in that same war, Eusebius said that tens of thousands of Jews had been killed. Eusebius was a Christian historian from the 300s AD. But then a further disaster came upon the Jewish people, especially to those who remained in the Palestinian region. In 132 AD, the Jews of Palestine again went to war with the Romans, and once more they were defeated, this time by the Emperor Hadrian in 135 AD. And we are told that 580,000 Jews were killed in that war. And this final war with the Romans proved to be the last straw of patience and allowance shown by the Romans to the Jews. In consequence of the Roman victory, Hadrian forbade any circumcised person from approaching within eyesight of the former city of Jerusalem. He even turned the city into a pagan city with the name of Aelia. So three major wars of the Jews with the Romans, 66 to 73 AD, the year 117 AD, and 132 to 135 AD, afforded a time of great demographic changes among those who were Jews and those who wanted to be Jews. The whole economy of Judea, which was located in central Palestine, declined precipitously over this period of 65 years, from 70 AD to 135. With Jerusalem and the temple gone, no money was being sent to the area, into that area, by Jews in other lands. With the Jews not allowed to own property in Judea, the economic benefits of their presence were drastically reduced. Even the surrounding Gentile lands, which before 70 AD had teeming population, that is, the land of Idumea south of Judea, and Moab and Ammon east of the Jordan River, all of them disappear from history. In other words, the people don't leave any records. Now, it is true, Justin Martyr said that there were many Ammonites in his day, in the 2nd century, the middle 2nd century AD. But even in the 1st century, Josephus called the people in the territories of Moab and Ammon, he labeled them as being Arabians. And this is Antiquities, Book 13, Chapter 14. And in the time of the Christian scholar Origen, in the early 3rd century AD, he said the areas of Moab, Ammon, and Idumea were at that time Arabic. This is in Origen's work on Job, in Book Number 1. Indeed, even the highly civilized Arab nation of the Nabataeans, who had their capitals at Petra and the Edomite city of Basra and Bostra, came to extinction as well in 106 AD when the Romans made that region part of the province of Syria. And this is when the Arabs from the desert areas to the south and east began to filter into these lands. There was simply no economic base any longer in the areas of Judea, Idumea, Nabatea, Moab, and Ammon to support the teeming populations that once lived in those areas before 70 AD. The Jewish-Roman War of 66 to 73 AD was not only devastating to the Jews in Palestine, but it caused multitudes of people to leave those districts for other regions of the empire. And we will discuss this more fully in future chapters. And with the final destruction of Jerusalem in 135 AD, all the peoples of these regions surrounding Judea abandoned the lands to incoming desert from the east and south. Tribes that did not depend upon the same type of economic system that governed those districts prior to 135 AD, and certainly prior to 70 AD. As Rabbi Simeon Bar Yakim of the Amora period stated, "The wicked Hadrian came and ruined the whole land." The observation of the Jewish historian Schurer on this desolation is very pertinent, and this is in his work, The History of the Jewish People in the Age of Jesus Christ, section 1, 553 to 55. He says, quote, "The whole of Judea was practically a desert. 50 forts were destroyed and 985 villages. 585,000 Jews fell in battle, and those who succumbed to illness or starvation were uncounted." So Jerusalem itself was changed by Hadrian into a Gentile military garrison, which he termed Aelia, after himself. As a matter of fact, Aelia became a frontier military town for the 10th Legion. In other words, a frontier town on the desert until the 10th Legion moved to Aqaba in the south about 285 AD. This is according to Benjamin Mazar, The Mountain of the Lord, pages 233 and 237. The whole region of Judea, Idumea, Nabatea around Petra, Moab, and Ammon east of the Jordan River became very backward economic areas, starting with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD, and especially after 135 AD. They did not recover even a measure of their former prosperity until the time of Constantine, when pilgrimages began once again to come to Palestine. And we will show that thousands upon thousands of those of people in those areas and adjacent ones in Syria and parts of Asia Minor went into all regions of the western part of the Roman Empire in the 2 centuries before Christ. The remaining part of these people who once lived in those prosperous areas before 70 AD, they followed their early brethren and migrated into other northern and western areas of the Roman Empire. These areas in the southeastern section of the empire did not revive in a population or economic manner until the time of Emperor Constantine. So after 70 AD, and especially after 135 AD, the real economic basis of the Middle East went back to Egypt, up to Antioch, up to the rest of Asia Minor, especially in its western parts. The western parts of the empire began to flourish. Rome, and even to the Rhone Valley in Gaul, in France, became quite prosperous. And because of this, and because many of their brethren were already in the West, thousands of people migrated out of Palestine and adjacent areas to the north and the west. This mass movement of peoples involved Jews, Samaritans, and peoples from the eastern side of the Jordan River and in Syria. The whole of Cyprus was repopulated with people from the east, and much of Cyrenaica, Libya today, was repopulated with eastern peoples in the wake of the Jewish decline in both the regions of Cyprus and Cyrenaica. Most people, however, went further west into Italy and even into Gaul and into Spain. And we will have more to say on these migrations in future chapters of this book. And so ends chapter 9 of The People That History Forgot, chapter 9, Neighboring Nations of the Jews in Palestine. So this has been a survey of the peoples around Palestine.
David, you've got time to go into chapter 10 if you'd like.
Okay. Let's get right into chapter 10.
Okay.
Take a drink of water.
Okay. Now, David and I have been having voice issues.
Separated by I don't know how many thousands of miles, but...
Yeah.
Okay, chapter 10 is titled The Solidification of Rabbinic Judaism. Once again, these are Dr. Martin's words. The Jewish people had to pay a high price in suffering and humiliation from the three wars that took place between 66 AD and 135 AD. But the outcome brought into being a Judaism that was basically united and solidified. That is, solidified into what we call Rabbinic Judaism today. With the full ruin of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the Jewish authorities, who continued the Sanhedrin, which were the central law courts of the Jews, and the body which was responsible for matters of the calendar and other ritual questions of Jewish religion, they moved from the ruined area of Jerusalem, they were required to move, to a town near the Mediterranean Sea called Jamnia. This was on a parallel line geographically with Jerusalem, and it gave the authorities a reasonable confidence that their observations for the calendar and calculations for the maintenance of the Jewish festival seasons would continue to be accurate in accordance with the legislation given by Jews, given by Moses in the Holy Scripture. After the war in 135 AD, however, Judea was so decimated, and the Jews were prohibited from living in the central regions including Jamnia, that the Jewish authorities moved the Sanhedrin to a town in Galilee called Usha, and they remained there paying their annual tribute to the Romans simply because they were Jews, which was called in Latin the Fiscus Judaicus. And there was much talk in the few years after 135 of moving the headquarters of Judaism to Mesopotamia, where there was still a large number of Jews in residence from the exile at the time when Babylon conquered Jerusalem in the early 500 BC. The Jews, however, finally decided to keep the Sanhedrin and other Jewish religious authorities in the Holy Land, which Galilee was considered a part. After about 60 years of isolation from the rest of the world, for all practical purposes, and with the Jews causing no more further problems to the Roman Empire, a most extraordinary thing occurred which benefited the Jews very much. They sided with Septimus Severus in his wars, and to their good fortune, Severus became emperor of the Romans in AD 193. The Severi dynasty ruled over Rome until 235 AD. And during those 40-some-odd years, the Jews prospered greatly. One of the reasons for this, besides the fact that they sided with Septimus, was because the Severide family was from an old Phoenician region in North Africa. In effect, these new emperors were not from the old Italian-Spanish stock that had previously governed the Roman Empire. Septimus Severus, or Severus, was the first emperor to govern Rome who was not of what we call Roman racial stock. He and his descendants were Phoenicians, and with a mixture of Syrian stock. We will see in the second part of this book that this racial makeup of the Severides, who governed the Roman Empire from 193 to 235 AD, was one of the reasons the Jews fared so well. In actual fact, the Jewish authorities began to reckon that the Roman emperors were brother people in race to the Jews themselves. More on this in the next section of this book. The Samaritans, however, were not so blessed during this period. They sided against Septimus Severus and were severely punished by Septimus, and according to the Samaritan Chronicle, they were kept under religious restrictions until the time of Baba Rabban in the early 4th century AD. The Jews, on the other hand, were given many privileges that reversed almost all the humiliation that they had endured for the previous 60 years. And though they were not given back Judea as a homeland or allowed to return to Jerusalem, they remained a people without a country, and they were also not allowed to proselytize. They were, nevertheless, blessed in a number of ways. The rabbi called Judah, Rabbi Judah, became close friends with the Severide emperors, and he was granted the title of ethnarch, or ruler of the Jews. Most importantly, Rabbi Judah was commissioned by the emperor to collect the Fiscus Judaicus, the annual tribute tax, which was still sent to the Roman treasury, as Origen tells us in his book, Ad Africanum, book 14. That Fiscus Judaicus was still sent to the Roman treasury, but this extra blessing for the rabbi was the Roman allowance that the patriarch of the Jewish people could himself tax those people within the Roman Empire in order to maintain. In other words, he could use some of those funds to maintain the Sanhedrin and numerous other government functions which pertained exclusively to the Jewish people. In short, Rabbi Judah, who became so famous later that among later Jews that they came to refer to him by his title, the Rabbi. Rabbi Judah became, for all practical purposes, the sole king of the Jewish people, wherever they lived in the world. He claimed to have Davidic connections in order to justify his role as the ruler of the Jews. He was even criticized by other Jews for living so regally because of all the money and prestige that was coming to the patriarchate in Galilee. And in all of this, the Roman imperial government backed up the rabbi's authority to rule with the Roman military forces. This is the time when rabbinic Judaism, as we know it today, came into its real existence. This rabbi was so powerful and supported by the imperial Roman government that he commissioned Jewish scholars under his command to garner together all of the oral laws, as they were called, which had been given to by the earlier rabbis, some of them going back to temple times. They were finally codified and called the Mishnah. Like the, quote, men of Hezekiah, end quote, talked about in Proverbs 25 and verse 1, who copied out various proverbs that became part of the Holy Scriptures, the rabbi was given the code name Hezekiah because he codified the Mishnah, which became a semi-canon for the beliefs of rabbinic Judaism. So important was the Mishnah after that, after the rabbi's death, that there were commentaries made on the Mishnah in both Palestine and Mesopotamia. These were called the Gemara, the completion. The commentaries were written down from the 3rd to the beginning of the 5th century. And the Mishnah, combined with the Gemara, are today called the Talmud. After the 40-odd years that the Severide dynasty controlled the Roman Empire, the Jews fared very well indeed. They still had to pay the tribute tax, and all the Jews of the empire also had to pay special taxes to the patriarchate for the running of this Jewish government within a government, within the government of Rome. But even this had salutary effects upon the Jews as far as the patriarchate was concerned. Since by this time the Samaritans were clearly reckoned as a distinct people, and they were out of favor with the Roman government and with the former proselytes and God-fearers of the 150 years before in the time of the temple, those people now having disappeared from the Jewish roll books, the patriarchate had the power to rule as to who was to be a Jew and who was not. Indeed, most Samaritans, and even those who still sympathized with Jewish religious beliefs, did not want to become practicing Jews, because they were then forced to pay the annual tribute to the imperial treasury, as well as pay taxes to the patriarchate. And even more galling, to come under the strict and absolute control of the patriarchate in Galilee. The initial period of 40 years for the establishment of the Jewish patriarchate was one that solidified Judaism among all Jews. And that solidification, in spite of many attempts to overthrow it, has in the main been sustained into modern times. It made Judaism a very unique and specialized religious society that the later Roman emperors, until the time of Constantine, over 100 years later, acknowledged and protected. In all the later persecutions the Roman government exercised against the various Christian groups, the Jews were in no way involved. When the emperor Diocletian commenced his persecution against the Christians in 303 AD, he gave orders to leave the Jews alone in either worship and society. Professor David Rokea, in his book, Jews, Pagans, and Christians in Conflict, pages 49 to 50, says, quote, "Not only is there no evidence that the Jews suffered from the persecutions instigated by the emperors Decius and Diocletian, but on the contrary, we have an explicit source in the Jerusalem Talmud, the Avot Zarah, chapter 5, 44d to the end, informing us that the Jews were distinguished from other peoples because of the empire, when emperor worship was enforced by Diocletian. Quote, all nations must offer libations apart from the Jews. In other words, they had an exemption. So the moderation toward Jewish people, which they had for about 125 years, came to an end with Constantine. And the Emperor Constantine caused a reversal of Jewish favoritism by Rome. But this reversal was not begun until about 324 AD. At that time, Constantine gave permission to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. It was in the form of a prayer to God. This is in Eusebius, Life of Constantine, Book 2, Section 55. And the Jews actually started to build the temple in 324 AD. According to John Chrysostom, Against the Jews, Book 6. But when some of Constantine's Christian advisors went to him about that matter of rebuilding the temple, the emperor had his mind changed, and he forbade them to continue building the temple. And he enforced that by cutting off the ears of those who were starting the construction. And this is again according to Chrysostom, Against the Jews, Book 6. The Holy Scriptures forbade any maimed person from entering the temple, let alone working on it. This is according to Leviticus 21, chapter 21, verses 17 to 23. So, Constantine cut off the ears of the priests building the temple, and this put a stop to the work. Constantine then became hateful toward the Jews, and they were not honored for the rest of his emperorship. The Jews only came back into grace with the Roman authorities at the time of the Emperor Julian the Apostate. This is between the years 361 to see 363 AD. Because of his hatred for Christian belief, Julian favored the Jewish people and granted them permission to rebuild the temple at Jerusalem, which was again started but frustrated because of Julian's death. Julian also rescinded the annual tribute, the half-shekel poll tax, which the Jewish people had paid since 70 AD, almost 300 full years. After Julian's death, the tribute was reinstated, which the Patriarchate collected for the imperial treasury. But near the end of the 4th century, that right for the Patriarchate to collect the money was annulled, and the Roman government officials took over the collecting until the Patriarchate was abolished by the Romans in AD 429. So for the 2.25 centuries after the Patriarchate ruled the Jews from Galilee until its demise in 429 AD, the Jews became a distinct religious society in the world. This is when the Mishnah and the Talmud were brought into existence. For the first century and a quarter, the Patriarchate ruled all the Jewish people without outward proselytes flocking into Jewish society. And this effectively sealed off Judaism from all other religions in the in almost dictatorial power among the peoples. And during this whole time, there is not a single complaint by Christian authorities that the Jewish people in their synagogues or in their homes were allowing paintings of the pagan deities to be displayed. Up to the time of Constantine, all mainline Christians themselves forbade such paintings, and the Jews did also. The paintings at the synagogue in Dura Europus, along with the small church that was there, were not devised by mainline Jews or mainline Christians. They were primarily heretics who came to be known as Gnostics. That is who created those artworks. The Jews even referred to their own heretics by the term Minim, M-I-N-I-M. And some of the statements in the Talmud, which describe their doctrines, almost certainly equates them with the teachings of Gnosticism. Indeed, Professor Friedlander believes that all of the Minim were Gnostics, and Professor Herford thought they were Jews with Christian tendencies. And this is mentioned in Morton M. Simon's Versus Israel, page 180. But almost all Gnostics, whether of Jewish extraction, Samaritan origin, or whatever, had some type, some kind of Christian interpretations attached to their doctrines. The fact is, the Minim, who were either Jewish or Christian schismatics, were not part of either mainline Rabbinic Judaism or mainline Orthodox Christianity. Yet, to those who made up the Rabbinic Judaism, the Minim were heretics. They were actually followers of Simon Magus and his successors. And as far as the synagogues in Galilee are concerned, which show idolatrous designs, these can be reasonably assigned to Samaritan attempts to build synagogues in the region while the Jewish Patriarchate was at its lowest ebb and when the Baba Rabban was in the prime of his life, the prime of his 40 years of rule, or in the time of his successors. Some burial tombs at Beth Sharim, with a few pagan decorations, can also be assigned to this same period, when Baba Rabban controlled much of Palestine and Galilee, and when he was building synagogues in the regions. The conclusion of this matter is this. In my view, it was a mistake to accuse mainline Rabbinic Judaism of sanctioning idolatrous paintings and symbols in certain synagogues and burial places. There were numerous other peoples within the first 4 centuries of our era who used symbols from the tabernacle or the Old Testament, and there were Samaritans, proselytes, God-fearers, and Gnostics, etc., who would also have been prone to use such religious depictions. The universal testimony of the Mishnah and the Talmud in stating an abhorrence for idolatrous designs, and the universal testimony of Christian scholars up to the time of Epiphanius in the mid-4th century A.D. to show an equal abhorrence by the Christians, and yet never once accusing the Jews of such practice. These are strong witnesses that the pagan designs and symbols were placed in certain synagogues and burial places by people other than mainline Jews. One must allow, of course, individual Jews, apostates, or even families, allow them the possibility of relapsing into paganism during the 4 centuries of our discussion. Of course, the Jews were always prone to do that. That's the whole story of the Old Testament and the prophets. But even granting this, even those few exceptions, in other words, by this time the Jews pretty much learned their lessons, even those few exceptions would still buttress the rule that mainline Judaism did not advocate idolatrous paintings or symbols, either in their public or private manner, among practicing Jews. The ones who were advocating the depiction of the various deities of the pagans in their synagogues and burial places must, in the main, be individuals or groups who had left the circle of rabbinic Judaism. So part two of this book will provide some historical information on the people who brought the paganized form of Judaism and Christianity into the Western world. So thank you, Georgianne, for allowing me to do these two chapters.
Well, thank you, knowing that your voice, you've been struggling with it. David, this paganized version of Judaism, would we today call that Zionism?
No, that would actually... that would be more like Orthodox Christianity.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, there was, Dr. Martin's point, of course, is that there was no Jewish paganism.
Mm-hmm.
Zionism appears to have been a Jewish thing that developed politically, in my understanding, because the Samaritans apparently, as we'll see, how the populations changed. And the Samaritans, when the Jews were in favor, they wanted to be Jews. Mm-hmm. When the Jews were out of favor, they wanted to be Samaritans, you know, and separate themselves. So they played that game quite well. We don't know how many Jews or Israelites today are actually Jews or Israelites, or are the descendants of the Samaritans, the Idumeans, or the Etrurians,
okay,
or the proselytes, who did eventually convert. And, of course, if they adhere to those teachings and doctrines, they are, by now, accepted as Jews. And also remember the Amalekites,
mm-hmm,
who looked Jewish, came from the lineage of Lot, the same from the same stock. And, they are quite, that might also be some of the peoples that John is referring to, as though those who say they are Jews and are not.
Yeah.
So there's quite a number of groups. To the extent that they are Zionist, it depends to the extent, you know, I don't think we'd be able to filter them out. That's my bottom line.
Okay.
I don't see how.
Okay. Well, this has been very informative, and I thank you, and I know that the listeners also thank you, David. And everybody, you can go to their website. It is askelm.com, and there are many books that you can read for free. There are many, many great articles there. You can also email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And, of course, you can go to the Byte Show, go to the audio library, click on David Seeloff's name, and his page opens up with oodles and oodles and oodles of audio files. Oh my gosh, David, I don't know how many there are, but there are many.
Well, last time, several years ago, it was over 200.
Oh my gosh.
So I don't know how many there might be now.
Well,
if anyone wants to go and count, let George Ann know.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you so much, David, and God bless everybody out there that's listening. Good night.